And now, back to brainstorming with Billy.
A perfectly good brain wasted.
Now, here's your host, Billy the Brain.
My next guest is a news anchor with a global perspective. He's also the published author of a book, Paddy Wagon, Fan Letters to a Stripper. We'll discuss President Barack Obama's pro-Muslim foreign policy and the impact that it's having on America. Bob Brill is an award-winning journalist with nearly four decades covering the news. Bob is a former UPI Radio Network correspondent who covered the Western White House during the Reagan years, the Olympics in Seoul, and various other stories around the country. He's traveled to 27 different countries, has a passion for international news and its effect on Americans here at home. Bob is currently an anchor at KNX 1070 News Radio, CBS Radio in Los Angeles. Welcome to the show. Welcome to the studio, Bob.
Thanks, Billy. Nice to be back.
Well, it's great to have you back, and it seems like we're always talking about foreign policy matters. I want to set this up for my listeners because this is a discussion that I've been wanting to have with you on the air for some time. President Barack Obama's foreign policy towards the Muslim world, to me, is an enigma. I mean, if you take a look at some things, back in June of 2009, President Obama made a conciliatory speech in Cairo, Egypt, to the leaders of the Muslim nation, and he had the perspective that we wanted to diffuse the tensions that were there and gain some friends and so forth. Yet, just 2 years later, when there were the uprisings in Egypt, he refused to step in and take a stand one way or the other there. Another thing, in that same speech back in 2009, he said no single nation should pick and choose which nations hold nuclear weapons. Now, to me, that's diplomacy speak for a green light for Iran if they want to develop nuclear weaponry, which we think they're in the process of doing, for them to go ahead and do that. And then in 2011, he authorizes Navy SEAL Team 6 to go in and assassinate Osama bin Laden, right in the midst of a Muslim country, Afghanistan. And he did not ask Afghanistan's permission to do that. He just went ahead and acted on that. And then most recently in May, President Obama told Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to return Israel back to the 1967 borders, which Netanyahu claims would be perilous to Israel as a state. So I'm asking you, if you look at all of the foreign policy towards the Muslim nations that we've had in the last few years of the Reagan administration, what picture is this painting?
Well, I think you have to set up the situation that the current president is in, and he's in a position that probably no other president in history has been in that since 1947, they've all had to support Israel. And that's been our policy.
Right.
Support Israel. It's the only democracy in the Middle East. Everybody else wants to blow it off the face of the earth.
Right.
You know. He's in a situation where things are changing in the Arab world. We've had the recent Arab Spring. And he is in a situation where he has to balance everything. And I'm sure it's a job he's hating to do right now. Mm-hmm. I'm sure if he went back and said, you know, what the heck did I do? Why did I run for president? You know, because I'm caught in this dichotomy. If you do one thing, you're damned. If you do another thing, you're damned. And he's been the first president that's really had to face the situation with a changing Middle East and a fear that, you know, we were attacked by someone from the Middle East. In 2001, 9/11, we were attacked by on our own soil, which had never happened before. The last time we were attacked on our own soil, realistically, was when the White House was burned by the British in 1812, in the War of 1812. So, you know, he's been in that situation where he's had to kind of walk that fine line. You look at the situation in where we took out Osama bin Laden in Pakistan.
Mm-hmm.
And any president of any note would have done, I think, the same thing. I don't care what John McCain says. I don't care what anybody else says. It was going to happen. And we were not going to trust the Pakistanis. Absolutely not going to trust the Pakistanis. There's no reason to. You know, they've been harboring this guy for a long time. Not everybody in Pakistan. But, I mean, he was living in a neighborhood with Pakistani intelligence officials. Give me a break. Did they know he was there? Of course they knew he was there. Now, you know, and they could say anything they want. And they're walking a delicate balance because of their situation with India. Both of them have nuclear weapons. Pakistanis, you know, they're a Muslim country, and they're trying to appease us. They're supposedly trying to knock off other Muslims in Afghanistan and helping us at the same time. So, you know, they're facing the situation that everybody else, the situation in the world right now is so tenuous and so quickly changing that it's almost unbelievable what the man has to deal with and an administration. And, you know, the other thing is, too, he walked in with very little national or international experience.
Yes.
You know, and this is one of the things that those who voted for him still had a situation where, you know, if I vote for him, he's going in and he's going to get ripped a new butt, you know, basically by the old establishment that's there. And that's basically what happened. It's been on the job training for him. And I'm not saying he's right or wrong. I'm not taking either side on that. But at the same time, he's had to walk this line that, no matter what he does, is going to be, you know, criticized. Now, one more thing about the Netanyahu thing.
Yes.
You know, if you, first of all, Israel is no way going back to its 1967 borders. And I listened to his speech. Matter of fact, we were covering that speech that he gave to one of the national Jewish groups the day after that to explain what he was saying. And he was saying, look, that's not really what I was. I don't expect Israel to go back to the 1967 borders with a 3-day Middle East war. I expect that to be a starting point to talk from. And I think that's where he got misquoted a lot on that. So
okay, well, misquoted and misunderstood. Those are two things that time will tell.
Exactly.
But I want to come back and return to what you said, because I would agree with your fundamental premise that Barack Obama had very little international experience jumping into this.
Right.
And this is the concerning part. This is the part I need clarity on. With no experience internationally, then why is President Barack Obama meddling with three countries that have nuclear arms that we don't really know what their intentions are? Those three countries are Israel and Pakistan and India, as you've just pointed out. You know, by poking Pakistan in the eye with a stick over this thing, you know, we are definitely challenged if they decide to get a hair under their skin about an issue with nuclear weapons. To me, wouldn't a more prudent approach have been, hey, I'm new on the job, I need to learn before I start making these inflammatory sorts of comments or doing inflammatory acts, should I not really weigh the situation a little bit more heavily, get my feet underneath me before doing so?
They weren't going to give him time to do that. The Republicans weren't going to give him time to do that. Absolutely not. And if you go back to the thing, people will say, okay, with Osama bin Laden, we should have talked to them. Okay. You want to do that? You want to see Osama bin Laden head to the mountains of Afghanistan? Go ahead. Tell them. Absolutely. Go ahead and work with the Pakistani intelligence and say, okay, we want you to help us take out Osama bin Laden. Hey, Osama, you know, get your porno tapes, get your other stuff, get out of town. The Americans are coming in with SEAL Team 6 in about 3 days. Mm-hmm. You got 3 days to get out of Dodge. Mm-hmm. Okay. And where does he end up? In the mountains of Afghanistan.
Yeah.
And then Obama gets criticized for that. So, I mean, like I said in my very first statement, is that he's in a position to be damned if he does, damned if he doesn't.
Well, that
and as far as, you know, the situation, we have to deal with these countries. You know, we have interests with these countries, whether it's India, which we have huge interests in. And remember, during the Cold War, India was not on our side.
That's
they were
right.
aligned with the Soviet Union. You know, and now they're more aligned with us. We need the help of Pakistan, which is a direct enemy of India, and they keep saying they're trying to talk. Matter of fact, they announced last week that they're going to start talks again over Kashmir, you know. And so they've got their own problems. We're involved with both. I mean, if you really want to go back to it, you have to go back to the end of World War II, where we had troops all around the world. We still do. Have troops all over
yes.
the world, you know. And there are people who say, well, that's empire building, you know. Well, okay, you know, I don't know what how you define that as empire building, and I know there are ways to do that, but I'm not so sure that is. But, you know, we have interests all over the world, and those countries depend on us. Japan depends on us for defense. You can argue all day long whether we should be involved there or not, whether they should be doing their own defense. And then, of course, you know, the question comes up, well, they got involved in World War II by having their own defense, you know. So each part of it is a real cultural problem. You know, each country has their own culture. And I was discussing this with my girlfriend last night about the salad bowl versus the melting pot. You know, we all grew up in the 50s and everything.
Right.
We're Americans and we're all blending and, you know, we're in this melting pot. Well, about 30 years ago, someone came up with the idea, and probably actually longer than that, but this is when I remember it, of the salad bowl. Okay. We were the melting pot, now we're the salad bowl. What's a salad bowl? We're all Americans in this big salad bowl. But some of us are onions, some of us are carrots, some of us are lettuce, and, you know, so I'm an Italian-American, I'm a German-American, I'm an Indian-American, and they all want their identities to be kept separate. They all want to be separate, but they all want to be Americans, and that's great. You know, so, I mean, you have this cultural thing, and all that comes from all over the world.
Sure.
Each one of those countries has their historical significance and their cultures and their foods and everything else. And that's wonderful. It's one of the things that makes America great. But at the same time, now, you know, and that sort of helps explain, you know, we're stuck in all these countries. We're Americans, and we're stuck in all these countries. And we are, you know.
Without a doubt. We're talking to legendary talker Bob Brill, and we're talking about foreign policy, U.S. foreign policy right now. Bob, I want to pick up with the military side of things for just a minute. We actually have bases all over the world.
Right.
Diego Garcia in the Indian Ocean. We also have bases in Arab countries that we are paying large sums of money to keep those bases there so we can keep our fleets having safe harbors around the world. And that money is going to people who...
Places like Yemen.
Yemen. Exactly. That's a great example. If we weren't paying them money, they would be our sworn enemy at that point, too. So, again, it's a thin line, as you pointed out, that a president has to walk. The question is this. If Obama becomes a one-term president, what does that leave for the next incoming president to take over with? Or if he is a two-term president, what can he do in that second term to, I guess, put us in a new direction when it comes to dealing with Muslim nations?
Well, I think most of all, he's going to be focused on domestic policy in the second term, if there is, because the Republicans are going to realize, like they did with Clinton, they're all going to have to work together, you know, and what's going to have to happen to make things better with our foreign policy is to get our domestic policy, our economic situation better, you know, and that because it's a global thing. I mean, it's happening all over the place. So, you know, I mean, if you look at the situation in the world, a lot is going to be determined what happens with the Arab Spring and what happens with Egypt. You know, Egypt has been promising democracy, democracy, democracy. Well, the military is still ruling that country. And, you know, it's going to be a major task to change that country over to a real democracy. And who, you know, and it would be a parliamentary country, you know, and therefore you have religious factions, you have this faction, that, you know, it's not a two-party system like we have here. And you can say all you want about the two-party system, but sometimes it works a lot better than a parliamentary system where you maybe have 15 or 20 different groups. So I think a lot of what's, you know, going to be determined for American foreign policy is what happens as this Arab Spring turns into an Arab summer and into an Arab winter. And because we just don't know who is in the opposition. For Libya, for instance, you had John McCain saying, well, we got to arm the rebels, you know, and we got to work with them. Who in the heck are they? We don't know who they are, you know, and are they members of Al-Qaeda mixed with other groups? You know, are they insurgents from Tunisia? Are they insurgents from Egypt? Are they Al-Qaeda? Are they just Libyan loyalists? You know, you don't know.
Yeah.
So a lot of that is, you know, going to be determined as far as what happens, you know, I would think, probably within the next year. And if Obama is a one-term president, it's going to, you know, we're going to have this all over again because we're going to have another 2 years. It takes a president 2 years to get his feet wet, no matter who they are. Everybody, I mean, dating back to George Washington, it takes them 2 years to get their feet wet. That's why the second term is so much more important than the first. You know, you got to get your feet wet, get established. And with him, because of his lack of foreign policy experience and international experience, it, you know, is taking a bit longer.
All right. We're talking to Bob Brill. Bob, let's change directions. Let's go to a different country in the world. Let's talk a little bit about China, if we can.
Yes.
Americans' foreign policy towards China is equally confusing to me. You know, I'd like your thoughts or your input on our foreign policy. We're poking China in the eye over things like Google devaluing the yuan, which is their currency, human rights, and so forth. Is it prudent for the United States to be poking the dragon, the Chinese dragon, in the eye when the Chinese dragon holds so much of our U.S. debt?
I think because of that, you have to. You have to keep them on their toes. You have to do, you know, you can't let them have their way with everything. One of the things that a lot of people don't really comprehend is that up until about 10 years ago, maybe 12 years ago, maybe not even that long. It's been in that time frame. China was not the consumer nation that it is now.
That's correct.
China is a consumer nation and is becoming more of a consumer nation. They're running into the same problems that we had in expansion. You realize that 15 years ago, there were no insurance companies in China?
Yes.
There was no reason to have insurance.
It was all state-owned.
I mean, yeah.
It was all...
Well, not only that, nobody owned anything. You know, I mean, there was no arson. We visited several I believe it was 2005, 2003, we went to China. We were working on a book project that didn't get off the ground. And we visited two fire stations, one in Beijing, one in Willamette. And they had not had, between them, they had had one arson fire in 12 years.
My goodness.
You know why?
Why? No private property.
Why do you commit arson? Either to cover up a murder or to gain insurance. Well, there's no insurance, so there's nothing to gain. So they'd have arson, you know. And, you know, we have collectibles, okay? The average Chinese place for three people to live, a mom and dad and a kid, is 300 square feet. And that includes the place outside the door in the hallway.
Mm.
300 square feet. You don't have any wall space. There's no place to put collectibles,
right?
You know. So China has become a consumer nation now. And real estate is going crazy over there. Prices are going up, especially in the major cities like Beijing and Shanghai and some of the other larger cities, even in the smaller cities, but especially in the larger cities. My son just wrote a couple of books on some smaller cities over there, and things are booming. Tourism is booming, and they're becoming a consumer nation. So they're becoming more and more like us.
Yes.
Yet, at the same time, they hold all of our debt. Not all of it, but a huge amount of our debt.
They hold a big, 25%,
yeah,
to be accurate.
And so, you know, why are we poking them in the eye? Because we have to keep them honest. And I've never felt that, you know, it should all be always one-sided. You know, we hold the debt, and we got to keep them honest. And they got to have that fear that we're going to default. You know? And that helps. I think that's a big thing.
But, well, clearly they've got the fear of default in them right now because of Congress wrangling over this. My guest
Debt ceiling.
The debt ceiling. And my guest is Bob Brill. Bob, you brought up something in that last answer. We've only got about a minute left. But in that minute, you mentioned that China's becoming more and more like us. They're a consumer society. Do you think that China is a bubble about to burst?
Yes.
Their consumer society is going to implode like ours did.
Absolutely. I said this 2 years ago, that China will do what it always does. It will implode. Historically, it implodes. And that is, you know, unfortunately, I really do believe that.
And we're going to have to leave it there, unfortunately, on a sad note. My guest has been Bob Brill, legendary KNX newsman.